Save on O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner. Get two cans of O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner for just $8. Valid in-store only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You obviously have a very high tolerance for murder.
He is beyond saving. And I lost a piece of my heart that I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
This is A Million Other Choices, and I am your host, Kim, and this is the murders of Susan Tice and Aaron Gilmore. In the summer of 1983, Susan Tice was a 45-year-old mother of three young men, Ben, Jason, and Jonathan, as well as her 16-year-old daughter, Christian. She was a complete adventurer who loved anything outdoorsy, painting, playing guitar, and just being a mom. She engaged anyone around her with her self-effacing humor and just kind of take-on-the-world attitude. She was a caretaking sort, and her kids' friends just all loved her. She was originally from Owen Sound, where she met and married her husband Fred after moving to Hamilton and then started her family. And Jason and Jonathan had been adopted, but Ben and Christian were actually her biological kids. And after studying nursing at McMaster's University and completing a master's in social work from the University of Toronto, and then started her own counseling center. And the family had moved to Calgary at that point, where she had actually returned to her studies in her 40s because Fred had had a job offer that he just couldn't turn down. I think he was in the investment business. But her husband, Fred, and her had decided to separate, and then both of them moved back to Toronto in July of 1983, and they bought separate houses, and then Susan got a job working with underprivileged kids. While they were married, the family had moved around quite a lot for Fred's career, which, again, I believe was in investments, and her career, both as a nurse and a social worker, had always kind of come second. So she was really excited to focus for the first time on herself with her kids now soon to be out of the house. And Christian, the youngest, like I said, she was 16. She was actually away at summer camp back in Calgary that summer. And without being tied down to Fred's pursuits, she purchased a place on Grace Street, which is just east of Bathurst in a part of town known as Palmerston, which is more commonly referred to as Little Italy. It was a two-story Victorian-styled house on 341 Grace Street. And it's one of those streets where the trees have provided shade for well over five decades, and the houses are set above a sidewalk that's split by retaining walls. So from the street, you have to walk up a few steps into the front yard, and then a few more steps to a front porch that lines the front of the houses, and then each house is separated to each other by just literally inches. The houses are similar in look and style enough to kind of get lost without having a house number, but the main distinction between the houses is kind of just the choice of the fabric on the front porch chairs and the color of the pansies that are planted along the front garden. Susan liked to write and often wrote letters to her sons who were away at school. And to her daughter, Christian, she would write about how she was decorating this new house and how she was keeping cool in the Ontario humid summer. She would put her clothes in the freezer for a little bit. She also kept a diary of her daily activities, which she would write in before going to bed each night. And that July, Susan had recently started to see a man that was turning romantic and was feeling very optimistic about her next chapter in life. In August, she took a break. She went on vacation to Owen Sound. Now, some reports say it was to visit her mother, and others say that she just went with friends. It's hard to say which, because Owen Sound is a retirement community. It's also well known as the Chicago of the North for its taverns and legal brothels. But it is a lake community, and Susan did take her car and had loaded her canoe on top of the roof rack and drove back on the 14th with a friend. It doesn't really matter. It's just one of those little details that I always like to know about. Around 11 p.m. on August 14th, which was a Sunday night, she returned to her house with her friend and they unloaded the car, which included unloading the canoe. So that took a little bit of time. And after they were finished, she drove her friend home, which was just a couple of blocks away, and then returned home, which would have been about 1 a.m. or so. On the Tuesday night, the 16th, she had plans to visit her sister Nan's for dinner in Brampton, but she didn't show up and she didn't call. So her sister and brother-in-law didn't think too much of it at the time, although it was a little odd for her not to at least call and let them know. But she had been busy. They knew she was returning from her trip and had likely had this late night. But they couldn't get an answer on her phone. So on the 17th, her brother-in-law, Bob, swung by her place to check on her. It was around lunchtime, and her brother-in-law noticed that the mail slot was overflowing, which was strange because her car was there. And the front door was locked, so he went around the back, which was the normal entrance that she used. Susan herself always used the back door, and so did any guests. This door wasn't locked, but it was slightly ajar. He peeked his head in and called for her, but was met with silence. And hoping she wasn't ill, he went in and noticed that the house was not really disturbed, but wasn't as neat and tidy as she usually liked to keep things. And so he climbed the stairs and he found Susan in her bedroom. She was partially on the bed and partially on the floor, with the covers half strewn over her naked figure. And there was blood, like a lot of it. Now, the bedroom definitely appeared ransacked. And while he was standing there in his shock, the phone rang. And when he answered it, it was a collect call from Christian. So he did not accept the charges and hung up and instead called the police.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
When the police arrived, they found in the bedroom, mixed in with this mess of empty drawers and clothing strewn around, was a broken glass bottle, which they believe had been used as a defensive weapon. There was blood in her bathroom sink from someone attempting to wash up, likely from an injury caused by the bottle. And they also found Susan's diary, which she wrote in faithfully every day. And she had written about pretty much right up till the moments until she was going to bed on the 14th. And then other than marking the date at the top of the next page for the 15th, there was nothing. And when they canvassed the neighbors, they learned that one of their neighbors had heard 4 screams around 1:30 a.m. on the 14th. And then someone walking by her place, which faces the back of Susan's house. Now, some reports say walking and some reports say actually running. But regardless, this person heard 4 screams, all of them at 1:30 in the morning, and didn't bother to call the police. She or he only mentioned it when they learned that their neighbor had been murdered, when the police asked him if they saw or heard anything. like after the fact. Like, can we just do a little bit better, please? Like, if I'm screaming, I'm not doing it for fun. And even if I am screaming at 1:30 in the morning for fun, I think you should still call the police and let them come and check on me, because obviously I need help of some kind. Susan's cause of death was 13 stab wounds resulting in a catastrophic loss of blood. But she was also sexually assaulted. Likely the sexual assault preceded her being stabbed and likely took her by surprise, which probably would have been scream number one. So, okay, I get that you might hear something and think, you know, maybe you dreamt it. But scream number 2, 3, and 4, like, come on. And I realize that for Susan's life to have been saved, someone would have had to call at scream number 1. The dispatch would have had to take it extremely seriously. And then the police would have had to hightail it there so that she could be rushed to the ER and probably surgery. And I know that that's a lot of what ifs and only ifs, maybes. But at least if you call and she still passes away, then you can say that you did everything that you could. I remember one time I was living in this, it's not so great area, and it was next to this seedy bar, and I heard a woman screaming in the middle of the night, and I called the police because I was pretty sure it was maybe just a young woman who was maybe drunk, but I wasn't sure. So I phoned. Because if I'd have woken up the next morning to a dead body in my parking lot, I would have never been able to live with myself. Anyways, in the end, it turned out it was a girl that was drunk and she had just broken up with her boyfriend and was screaming and crying about it, but still. And I get that sometimes you get a dispatcher, they don't really care, they don't really check anything out, but even if it makes you feel stupid for phoning, as Gavin De Becker says, a moment of embarrassment is worth a lifetime of regret. Anyways, nobody saves Susan. But whoever this monster was had left a plethora of physical evidence behind, including his semen, blood, hair, and fiber, fingerprints galore. But in 1983, they were pretty limited in what they could do with any of that stuff. I mean, fingerprints were kind of hit and miss, and the process of matching them was pretty manual. And blood and semen samples took more than just a little drip and drab here. They had to, you know, before they could do anything with it, all they could really do was blood type it at that point. But if you consider that 40% of the population is type A, I mean, forget trying to narrow it down. So they were stuck with interviews, good old-fashioned detective work. They eliminated the boyfriend, the ex-husband, the brother-in-law, her neighbors, the dry cleaner, and anyone who had ever spoken to Susan, at least in the 2 months that she'd been in Toronto, and they kind of came up with nothing. Sue's husband, Fred, was a suspect right away. He had been pretty bitter after the breakup, and although he had been ruled out really early on, the family kind of started to splinter over it. Christian and her brothers, they completely stopped speaking to each other, and Fred really struggled, continued to be under some of the family members' suspicion. Sue's death, like Sue had admittedly been the glue that kind of held the family together. Christian told the Toronto Star about her family. Sometimes families are brought closer. It blew us apart. And Christian actually became pretty obsessed with her mom's murder and looking for clues into like who could have done this and what actually happened that night. And within walking distance of Grace Street, just a bit east, is Hazelton Avenue in New Yorkville, where lived the 22-year-old Erin Gilmore. And Erin was the oldest in the family and the only daughter, as she had been born to her mom, Anna and David Gilmore. And the couple later divorced. Anna remarried a couple of times, as did David. Anna went on to have 2 sons, Sean and Kaylin, with her second husband. And her stepbrothers were adored by Erin from the moment that they entered her life. And the family moved for a time to Greece, but they returned to Toronto. And Erin had a passion for the fashion industry, and she studied at the Fashion Institute with dreams of becoming the next Kate Spade. She liked photography and to sketch. She had been lucky enough to get a job at a rather swanky clothing boutique, or it was called Robin Knits, and rented the apartment that was actually right above the shop in this chic and upscale neighborhood. Erin didn't have to work. She had actually been born into wealth. David Gilmore had been the son of an investment dealer and an opera singing wife. And David had given up a chance to work at his father's firm, and instead he had opted to move to Montreal to sell pots and pans door to door. And one night at a restaurant called Diana Sweets, met engineering student Peter Munk, and the two of them came up with this idea to import Scandinavian furniture. And they later moved on to found Claritone Stereos, and that business was successful enough that when they sold it, they had enough cash to purchase a hotel in Fiji and turn that into the South Pacific Hotel Corporation. In 1980, they sold the hotel, which was now a chain of 54 properties, and turned to investing in Canada, including Trizac Han and Barrick Gold. But like her father had before him, she wanted to forge her own path and had chosen to pursue her passion rather than investing. But she had enjoyed the lifestyle her parents provided to allow her to travel abroad quite a bit. She was a hard worker on her own right, though, and never described in the slightest as privileged or anything. She was just really down to earth. Erin had originally asked her dad if she could come and spend a year in Fiji working as a teacher there. And Erin had, of course, spent quite a bit of time in Fiji vacationing at the resorts that her dad owned and had become familiar with the country. But David felt it was important for her to finish up her fashion studies first. So that's why she had taken the job and the apartment there. And 4 months after Susan had been killed, the Gilmores were making Christmas preparations. And on the 19th of December, the boys were off school for the Christmas holidays. So they stayed over at Erin's apartment, which was kind of a treat for them. Sean was 13 and Kaylin was 11 at the time. They spent the night eating popcorn, watching scary movies. And the next morning, she piled them into her Jeep and drove Kaylin off back to her mom's house. And Sean had some Christmas shopping that he wanted to do, so she dropped him off, likely on Yonge Street. And Erin had a shift at work that day, and then she had plans to go out with some friends to a Christmas party, which I believe included her boyfriend, who was coming to pick her up right after work. She spoke to her mom, Anna, and mentioned that she wasn't feeling at all that great, but she was well enough to finish her shift and she was going to go to this gathering with her friends, but probably wouldn't be staying late because it was a super cold night that night. And so curling up under the covers sounded a lot more enticing than socializing. So Erin got off work sharply at 9 o'clock. She walked from the store to the bottom level around the left side of the building where the stairway was that went up to her front door. And she was just going to go in there and get ready for her friend, who was actually Anthony Munk, the son of her dad's business partner and also her boyfriend. He was supposed to be there at 9:30, so he had stopped at the bank on the way to take out some cash. And he arrived at Erin's place at 9:20, walked up the 5 steps to her front door and noticed it was slightly ajar, which he assumed had been sort of left that way so that he could just call from her from the door without having to take his shoes and boots off when he got in there. But he was answered by silence, so he went in to look for her. He found her in the bedroom and thinking she was asleep because there was just basically a lump under the duvet covers. But when he pulled the covers back, he found that she was bound with her hands tied behind her back. She had been gagged and in a bloody scene with multiple stab wounds to her torso and neck. In his shock, Anthony initially told dispatch that he thought she had committed suicide. She was later found to have been sexually assaulted. Police were baffled by the very, very short timeline of this 20 minutes between getting off work and then being found, and then found to have been sexually assaulted and then tied up and stabbed to death. And with the perpetrator to not have been seen or heard coming or going. They believe that whoever it had been had either grabbed her outside her apartment and forced her inside or had been inside the apartment and waiting for her. Initially, based on the vicinity to Susan's murder and the similar MOs, they suspected that Susan and Erin's murders might have been connected. The problem was in making that connection. They interviewed about 700 people looking for someone that they could link the two women who were complete strangers to each other. Complicating things were that Erin had thrown a party the weekend before, which of course left Prince and extra people to interview. And they traced over their lives looking for anything, like even the same grocery store that they maybe stopped at or dry cleaners they used. And again, they came up with nothing. They took blood samples from hundreds of people and compiled boxes of notes and documents. So despite a lot of physical evidence at both crime scenes, both of their cases went cold. And in the year 2000 started this thing called the National DNA Databank. Now, as great as this whole databank thing was, it had its limitations. The biggest limitation was that only people convicted, and convicted is the big key word here, for certain crimes were legislated to require their DNA to be put into this database. Now, that doesn't mean if you're arrested and fingerprinted that you automatically get your DNA taken as well. And maybe that's a good thing. I've never murdered or raped anyone, so I guess I would see it as unfair if I was arrested for, say, disorderly conduct or something, and then they matched my DNA to a murder from 10 years ago. I mean, constitutional rights and all that good stuff. Actually, I guess the main reason I wouldn't want it is that I've never committed a crime. And if I did ever find myself arrested for something minor, I wouldn't want to be framed for something that I didn't do. But I probably watched too much TV in the 80s or something. Anyways, it was only people convicted of sexual assault or murder, really, that had their DNA taken and put into this bank. And although it was nice to have this bank to draw from, it wasn't all that helpful in older crimes because they weren't allowed to go back and take DNA from people that were already in prison for murder or sexual assault unless they were deemed to be a dangerous offender, which is a legal term and not just what you and I would consider as somebody who's dangerous. Basically, it only applies to Paul Bernardo. Any other prisoners, they had to get a warrant. So they had to sort of already be narrowed down as a suspect, and then you had to have a reason and blah, 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 blah. Basically, it falls under unlawful search if you just go around nabbing people's spit. It was a new tool for the police, but not necessarily a very effective one, especially with regard to cold cases. And they were starting to fear that after 17 years, Susan and Aaron's murders, if they were the same person, were probably dead. However, they did find that the data bank was useful for at least holding DNA samples that they had collected from crime scenes and matching them up wherever they could. And in the case of Susan and Aaron, matching them to each other's crime scenes, if not to a person in the system. Now, this next part, there's a little bit of dispute over exactly how things went down. But one account is that Sean, who's Aaron Gilmore's brother, who was always very outspoken in the media about trying to keep Aaron's name out there, learned about this Golden State Killer genealogy thing that it was kind of the talk of true crime everywhere, and still is, and probably deserves its own episode on that, and called the task force and asked them if they could, this could maybe be useful. But other accounts are that it was Detective Stephen Smith, who had transferred to the Cold Case Unit in 2017, who attended that course on genetic genealogy talked a ton about before and decided to give that a whirl. And while he was also working the Christine Jessup case that we've talked about, anyways, the rumor is that he submitted the samples in 2019 from Christine, Aaron, and Susan's crime scenes to the Texas firm Othram, who did this fancy schmancy sciencey thing called single nucleotide polymorphism, which measures for minute genetic variations that are passed from one generation to the other. And by comparing the results for two different individuals, they figure out somehow that they're related, like whether they're first or second cousins or something like that. Although it's a much, much broader and more robust data bank than the national DNA one, it's dependent on who has uploaded their DNA profiles. So in the end, it was coming back to possible fifth or sixth cousins, which are practically not even related by that point. They are so far removed from each other. But Toronto happened to have this wee tiny little team of genealogists on the force. And they started trying to track down the family members of these distant relatives. And they came up with 8 possible family trees and 3,000 possible names. And these families, I mean, they were rural families having like 6 to 8 siblings each and so many nieces and nephews your head would spin. But there was this one guy that they kind of narrowed in on. He was the only brother of one of the families of 5 boys that was living in Toronto at the time of Aaron and Susan's murders. He was only 22 at the time. He was now 61 and living in this very small northern town of Moosonee, plastering his Facebook page with hunting photos. But they had arrived armed with a warrant for his DNA. And wouldn't you know, Toronto PD finally had their guy. And even better, he was alive and well. Joseph George Sutherland, a name and face that have never been on anyone's radar for 40 years. And on November 28th, 2000, On November 28th, 2022, he was arrested and charged with two counts of first-degree murder. It had taken 3 years to go through that huge family tree and find their needle in a haystack. Unfortunately, Anna McCowan, Aaron's mom, died in 2020, and although hopefully reunited with Aaron now, didn't live to see justice for her daughter. David Gilmore, Aaron's dad, who had bought an island in Fiji, actually, after selling off his hotel business and started Fiji Water. Yes, that one. He also built preschools in Fiji and the U.S. to honor Aaron's life. And in 2004, was awarded the Award of Corporate Excellence by the U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. He died of a heart attack on June 11th, 2023. Joseph Sutherland didn't plead guilty to the charges until October 5th, 2023, and managed to get it down to second-degree murder. Joseph had gone into IT, moving around Northern Ontario, working and just living the dream. He was married between 1995 and 2000. He had a son who was living with him at the time of his arrest. He was 21. No, he was 22, which was the same age that he was when he committed his crimes and the same age as Aaron when he killed her. But Joseph wasn't going to go down easy. His defense lawyer requested a Gladue report, which, now I've mentioned these Gladue reports before, and they came into effect in 1999. It's basically a report that Indigenous accused can request before being sentenced, where the court is to take into account the effects of colonialism and Indigenous people and try to reduce the overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples in the correctional system here in Canada. The life sentence part of his conviction stands no matter what. It's only taken into account for mitigating factors regarding the parole ineligibility period, which, if you've been hanging around me long enough, you know that for first degree is 25 years and a minimum of 10 years for second degree. The Crown was asking for 20 years in this case, and the defense was hoping that this Gladue report would garner enough sympathy from the justice to get 2 years shaved off of that. Joseph had been born on James Bay, and his dad died when he was 7 years old. He was sent to St. Anne's Residential School, where he was abused and torn from his community and lost his Cree language. He left St. Anne's when he was 10, dropped out of school in eighth grade, started drinking for the next 10 years, and basically doesn't remember murdering anyone, saying, quote, "My mind erased it because my mind broke. You can't feel something if you don't remember it." But that's interesting because in his ask for leniency, he wanted the judge to consider the fact that he went on this spiritual quest back in the day to find the spirits of Susan and Aaron to ask them for forgiveness. It's strange that he remembered that, but not remembered murdering them. The victim impact statements, Sean, Aaron's brother, said, "It took you 40 years. If you had come forward and asked for forgiveness, I might have been able to forgive you in a small way, but you didn't. We're here today because of Steve Smith and his team and all the detectives who worked on this over the years who never gave up. I have nothing but hatred for you." Fortunately, Justice Morin Forstell didn't buy much of Joseph's poor me argument and said, "While I accept what Mr. Sutherland told the author of the report, that he had tried to forget what he'd done, I do not accept he does not remember the first and only vaguely remembers the second homicide. The two murders that Mr. Sutherland committed were profoundly serious. They were killed in their homes, which should have been places of sanctuary. The impact of violence has continued to be felt by other victims in this case, families and friends. Given the circumstances of the case, including the vulnerability of the victims and the violations of their homes and their bodies, a parole eligible near the highest range permitted was appropriate," end quote. And you can bet your baby babkas that Toronto cold case detectives are looking pretty closely at other unsolved homicides around 1983 and making a timeline of his movements, because his crimes showed way too much misogynistic rage to have been one-offs, despite his ex-wife saying that he never was violent with her. And that was the murders of Aaron Gilmore and Susan Tice. And I'm going to be back again next week with another episode. In the meantime, what can you do? You can do your rate review thing. You can sign up for the exclusive episodes on the exclusive feed that, again, is $5 a month, $1 a week. I think it's $50 a year in the U.S. And you can watch on YouTube. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.